This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Climate Countdown 2019.
Years, countless of people have stood in front of the United Nations climate conferences, asking our nation's leaders to stop the emissions. But clearly, this has not worked since the emissions just continue to rise. So I will not ask them anything. Instead, I will ask the people around the world to realize that our political leaders have failed us, because we are facing an existential threat, and there is no time to continue down this road of madness. Today we use 100 million barrels of oil every single day. There are no politics to change that. There are no rules to keep that oil in the ground. So we can no longer save the world by playing by the rules, because the rules have to be changed. We have not come here to beg the world leaders to care for our future. They have ignored us in the past and they will ignore us again. We have come here to let them know that change is coming, whether they like it or not. The people will rise to the challenge, and since our leaders are behaving like children, we will have to take the responsibility they should have taken long ago. Thank you.
Rough sea. Full moon. The tide is coming in.
The struggle continues. You just heard 15-year-old Greta Thunberg addressing Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations. That was December 4th at the COP24 International Climate Talks in Poland. As we enter the most difficult times humanity has ever faced, most people are coasting, hoping the crash won't come, believing the harsh reality is not real. That leaves us lots to talk about here on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for tuning in. We begin this year with the grand old man of coastal science, Dr. Oren Pilkey.
It's really going to be a major shakeup of this country, for sure, and all over the world as well.
Pilkey warns we must begin withdrawing from the coastline now, or wait for the coming panic. Then we dial the climate clock back a couple of hundred million years. That is when a massive warming on Earth drove most species to disappear, to extinction. From the University of Toronto, Dr. Ulrich Wortmann explains the terrible similarity to our current voyage to Hot World, with no one in the wheelhouse. Stay woke, here it comes. As the world warms, humans will have to move back from the ocean, cities and all. Oren H. Pilkey wrote a book on it, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. In North Carolina, he is the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences. Dr. Pilkey published over 250 works and 45 books. Duke University named a building after him. And I hope Dr. Pilkey will not mind if I called him the granddaddy of coastal science. From Durham, North Carolina, Oren Pilkey, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So over the past centuries, Americans did move massively from the interior to the coast, and that's where we find fabulously priced real estate and movies about seaside bliss. Are you really sure that is going away, whether we like it or not?
I think there's not the slightest doubt that it's going away, primarily because of sea level rise. A second factor is the expected intensification, a factor that works here, at least on the southeastern U.S., an intensification of hurricanes. This, in the last 2 years, we have 18 storms, hurricanes, North Atlantic hurricanes. That's not unusual, but what is unusual, we had five of those 18 were really big storms causing a lot of damage. And I think that's the beginning of the expected intensification of storms based on the warming of the ocean.
Yes, it's true. A single giant storm can practically rewrite the coastline.
That's for sure. The biggest disaster in those storms was Puerto Rico, where the storm, a Category 4 storm, almost Category 5, just crossed the whole island. It was really a disaster. And it killed, they have estimated, more than 2,000 people. A real disaster, if ever there was one.
Didn't a storm turn you toward your lifetime work?
Yes, as a matter of fact, my parents retired in Waveland, Mississippi, right at a house that was an elevation of 13 feet. And they had Hurricane Camille in 1969 that came through. Now, Hurricane Camille was one of the biggest ever to hit the U.S. Not the biggest, but the most intense. 200-mile-an-hour winds were actually recorded on land, and their house was basically was severely damaged. The house then disappeared completely in Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Anyhow, my brother and I went down to Waveland, Mississippi to help the parents, and I was so impressed with the power of nature at the shoreline. I hadn't even thought about it. At this time, I was more of an oceanographer going to sea. This basically turned me into a, shall we say, a shallow water person rather than a deep water person. It was so impressive. It's just hard to describe.
Apparently, millions of us humans think we can fix this, maybe with new sand dunes or floating stilt homes or some technology. Can we fix it, really?
In my opinion, there is no, we cannot fix it. We can do something. Building a seawall, which will destroy the beach, but building a seawall will sometimes offer shelter for an intermediate storm, but not a big storm. We can pump up sand on the beach, which we call beach replenishment. That does stop some damage because the storm concentrates on taking away the sand rather than taking away the hull. But basically, in a time of rising sea level, we simply cannot hold the shoreline still. Most of our efforts are to hold the shoreline still, and the shoreline wants to move back because of the sea level rise.
Did North Carolina actually pass a law against predictions of rising seas like yours?
Well, they almost said that. They didn't quite say it that way, but that's the way it kind of came out in the media, and it wasn't far from that. North Carolina in 1985 passed the first regulation prohibiting seawalls, which was a giant step forward. I was very proud of them. And because the reason they prohibited seawalls is because they eventually destroy beaches. And, of course, beaches are critical to coastal living, especially in a coast like ours, which has a lot of tourists and so forth. But they somehow changed administrations, and there was a lot of resistance to the idea that you couldn't build a seawall and so forth. So they said, they decided, instead of looking at a sea level rise of 3 feet or so, which is what most communities are looking at, they decided to look at a sea level rise of in the next 30 years, which was 8 inches. In effect, they said, we'll ignore sea level rise. And in fact, the way it was interpreted often was they made sea level rise illegal, which in effect, they actually did. It was really irresponsible and even stupid in the context of what we know is going to what we know is happening right now.
In 2012, right after Hurricane Sandy, I spoke with Professor J. Court Stevenson from the University of Maryland. And we talked about surge defenses in cities around the world. So let's talk about some of the great cities of the American South. Can cities there successfully retreat from the shoreline, and will they have time to do so?
Actually, each city is different. Each city is different, has a different problem. Miami has the worst problem because Miami is situated on top of a thick 20 to 75-foot thick limestone that is extremely porous. And to give you an idea of what that means, a small pond within the city of Miami actually show tides. Maybe just an inch or even less than that, but tides that correspond with the offshore tide. This means that, in effect, Miami is really sitting in the water. They can't build seawalls to help them. They can't build levees or dikes. So I anticipate that Miami will have to be completely abandoned within this century, probably within 50 years or so. New Orleans is a different situation. New Orleans is fine until the inevitable Hurricane Camille type, a very strong hurricane, comes by and floods the city again. I anticipate that at some unknown time, New Orleans will also have to go away for sure. Wilmington, North Carolina, which is flooding quite a bit right now due to the so-called nuisance tides. These are high tides that come around as a result of, they're really the old spring tide, but they're higher now because of sea level rise. Anyhow, Wilmington is another city that's quite low. And, you know, sometimes portions of the city are quite high and are not going to be impacted by sea level rise directly. But if the surrounding area is flooded, which is often the case, the roads coming to the higher areas are flooded. And so you can't go to grocery stores, can't go to schools, churches, and so forth. So you can't just look at the amount of flooding from, let's say, a 3-foot sea level rise. You have to consider the whole big picture and what that does to transportation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, of the big projects that people around the world have invested in right by the ocean. Boston's Big Dig, the new tunnel in downtown Seattle, or the airport built out on the sea like Japan's Kansai International Airport. We're investing trillions of dollars of social wealth in these projects as though you never wrote your books and papers, as though the scientists around the world have never warned. That's a bad idea.
Yeah, it's hard to deal with the city problem, you know. But I think we can learn something from the Dutch. The Dutch, now, they're not like the United States. They're a very small country. There's no place to move to. A good part of the country is below sea level. They're building big, big, huge dunes along the shoreline, and which they kind of have to. Remember, they're in a different situation than we are. And they're doing things like designating parks and parking areas as to be flooded. One big park in Holland actually has tennis courts and soccer fields and swimming pools. And the whole reason that park exists, it's a place to be flooded in the case of a big storm. And, of course, they're also put a big gate across at Rotterdam, across the mouth of the estuary, a 70-foot high wall that will move back and forth. That they can do because they have to, and it's a wealthy, well-educated country. But for us, we don't have that privilege. We're going to have to, in our cities like New York, have a lot of pretty good elevation, although 40,000 people in New York City live at elevations below 3 feet, and all those and a lot of others will have to move somewhere. Boston can temporarily solve its problem by building a massive seawall in front of around the front of the city. Boston is in large part made up of very low elevation, pumped up mud from the Boston Harbor, and so it's all of downtown Boston is very very low and very vulnerable. But they can, unlike Miami, they can protect themselves for a while with a big seawall. But if the sea level rise goes up to as much as 6 feet, which is some people think it's getting up that way because of increased melting of the Antarctic ice sheet, Then Boston, especially during a storm, is going to be in very serious problems. So each city is different, and some cities are more protectable, so we say, than others. There is no city that is not going to be, no coastal city that is not going to be severely impacted. And, of course, all the ports and harbors of the world all the docks are going to have to be raised. And, of course, that makes a big problem for commerce and for the military, too.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people about the situation of the U.S. Navy and the Coast Guard and where their bases are and how much they're already flooding, some of them. You know, we tend to pay attention when cities flood, but not when damaged coasts kind of collapse into the sea. Erosion on the coast isn't news, but should it be, Orrin Pilkey?
Oh, absolutely. We, we have here in North America, we have, well, in the U.S., we have 3,000 miles of barrier islands. These are the most vulnerable major coastal environment there is. And it's a huge thing economically, of course, with all the tourist industry. In the state of Florida, in a recent study there, that looking at the population of people of Americans who live below 3 feet in elevation, New York was number one. 49,000 people live below 3 feet in elevation. But of the 25 cities that they looked at, 20 of them were in Florida. So Florida is in really bad shape, potentially. And their governor, who has now been elected to be their senator, does not believe in global climate change. That doesn't help the situation. We should be making plans. You know, I've talked about all the evacuation that's going to happen. One problem we see is that there's nobody planning on that evacuation. Where are 4 million people? That's the number expected from Miami. Where are 4 million people going to go? As you pointed out, we've had a lot of evacuations in the past, like our Dust Bowl in the 20s, and after World War II, a massive movement of people from the south to the north. But those were individuals who just went one at a time, and so forth. But now we're thinking about 4 million people who are probably going to move in a relatively short period of time. We better do some planning.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from North Carolina. My guest is the well-known expert on how shorelines work, Dr. Orrin H. Pilkey. We're talking about the inevitable march of the sea into the land that we thought was ours as the world warms. Well, you raised a really great point there, because when we talk about rising seas, too many Americans think it will strike islands in the South Pacific or Bangladesh. But there was a recent study in Nature Climate Change. It was published in March 2016, titled "Millions Projected to Be at Risk from Sea Level Rise in the Continental United States." And they project that, as you say, with more intense storms and the rising seas, we will see a movement of people not seen in the United States since the Great Migration from the South during the last century. This is going to be startling news for the next generation or two, I think.
Boy, oh boy. Look, I'm just thinking, I often think about my grandchildren and what they're going to be facing and what their children are going to be facing. It's really going to be a major shakeup of this country, for sure, and all over the world as well. The three places which are going to be flooded most intensely and will produce the most refugees, one is South Florida, particularly Miami. Two, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach and so forth, Daytona Beach. Then the second one is the Mississippi Delta, where there are about 2 million people who are expected to be fairly quickly displaced by sea level rise, meaning probably within this century or maybe just a little past the end of this century that they will have to get out of there. And the third large area that's going to be flooded but doesn't have too much population is what we call the Inner Banks, which is a large, flat, swampy area behind the Outer Banks of North Carolina and partly in Virginia. There are probably less than a million people, but that whole area will be flooded.
And we're also talking about coastlines in, well, the city of Sydney and Shanghai and parts of Vancouver will be lost. And it's a long shopping list around the world. This is going to be a global change for the coming generations, I think.
It most certainly is. It most certainly is a global problem. I've been in our book, we concentrated primarily on the U.S., but boy, some of the stories coming out of Bangladesh, for example, you know, when they get a big hurricane, the numbers of people who are missing or killed are 100,000 or so. And what they have done, by the way, is pretty interesting, because people can't really escape. The road system isn't good enough. Not everybody doesn't have a car and so forth and so on. So they have built a series of shelters, very substantially built shelters that can withstand winds and are high enough off the ground with stilts and so forth that they will not be impacted by a hurricane. And so people can rush to their nearest shelter and crowd in there while the storm is going on. It's something that could be used here, too. We have a real problem with people escaping from our cities in Charleston, South Carolina, and in the Mississippi Delta. Here we've had storms come by in which people tried to get away, like in Katrina, tried to get away, and they ended up being jammed on the highway with, and in the case of Charleston, they had a four-lane interstate coming into the city, but they kept two of those lanes open for, quote, emergency vehicles. So everybody in Charleston who wanted to escape had to go out the two lanes. And it seems so strange to see these photographs of the two lanes which are jammed because of accidents and so forth. People ran out of gas. And on the other two lanes, there's nobody, not a thing going on. And that we've got to do some more planning, some better planning on evacuation. And I think we learned some lessons from the fires in California recently, where they had pretty good plans for that city of paradise and of escape routes, but then three of the four escape routes were covered by smoke and were impassable. It's a different situation, of course, but it's the same kind of problem. To get people away during emergencies needs some more planning. We really need to work on that.
So facing an unstoppable ocean over time, can you expand further on what you mean by walk away methodically? What should happen? What could happen?
What I'm saying is we should be retreating now. We should not wait until the wolf is at the door. We should be moving now. For example, every time a storm occurs on any shoreline, anywhere, we should not replace that building. Buildings that are damaged should not be replaced. That's one possible way to begin retreating. And others, we're just going to have to start moving back, and we can do it in a planned fashion, I think. It will be expensive, and it will be painful. But if we don't do that, then in 30, 40, 50 years, we will move back, whether we like it or not. But we'll move back in what I call tactical disarray. It'll be even more costly, and it'll be a mess. Everybody's moving right now quickly, so let's do it now.
We've got to change our whole idea of insurance, too. The private industry bailed on insuring a lot of coastal properties. I thought that might discourage people, but no, the states' governments rushed in with their own insurance, backed by all of us taxpayers. At some point, we've got to give up on insuring people and paying them to rebuild just where they were already wiped out by the sea.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yes, that's exactly the point. And the insurance, we have federal flood insurance, among other types of insurance, and that is, I think, $12 billion in the red. We should raise insurance premiums to the point that they will pay for the risk. As it is, the public pays for the risk because the insurance is not sufficient. The premiums are not sufficient to pay for the damage. If that happens, the cost of living near the shore would raise instantly, very quickly, and it would discourage a lot of development. Discourage of near-shore development is a good thing.
From a scientist's perspective, does it matter whether the President of the United States believes in rising seas?
Yeah, that's the most difficult question because, well, I guess it's not difficult. In fact, it matters a lot. the thing is most distressing of all is not only does he not believe in global climate change, but we are actively working against global climate change. We're actually taking moves that will favor increased rates of climate change, such as putting tariffs on solar panels, changing the mileage requirements on cars, and so forth and so on. So many ways that we are actually making the problem worse. So it does make a big difference. And I think we have been in the past, at least, a leader. We've taken international leadership here and trying to fight, start to make moves against global climate change. But boy, that has gone away completely now.
In 2016, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Australia's Charlie Varan, and it was heartbreaking. He explored and he documented the coral world that he loved, and now he's charting its demise. As one of the great educators about the coast, I think you were in the same position. True?
Well, yes. Yes, I did. I have been there from the beginning, so to speak, because I'm an old man now. I can remember, and then I can remember when 30, 40 years ago, when it was radical to say things like we can't build seawalls if you're going to destroy the beaches, and we've got to plan retreat. I am so pleased that that is no longer a radical thought, but there was a long time there where it was so discouraging, and I took a lot of heat, to put it mildly. In one small town in South Carolina, the city council passed a resolution saying that I was no longer welcome to come there. But at any rate, that's part of the game, and I kind of recognize that in a way that attitude was a sign that I was actually having some impact.
Well, the sea will pass a motion saying that the people in that little town will no longer be welcome there as the tides keep coming in, I suppose. Now, Oren, I know you have talented children. They have co-authored and even illustrated some of your books. But now, as you and I start to get kind of oldish, what can we tell our grandchildren, or should we tell them at all?
Oh, I think we should tell them. I think we would want our grandchildren to be really aware of the situation. And every individual has opportunities to make the point, in your breakfast table conversations about, if we're going to get a car, Dad, why don't we get a car with low mileage? We don't want any of those big cars, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, I think everybody needs to be educated. And my grandchildren or our grandchildren will certainly vote someday, too. In fact, one of mine is already voting. And he is voting in the right way as far by my definition. I think education is so important. And look, we wouldn't have a president like as the type that we have if he had been educated in his younger days, if he was aware. The people need to understand about science. We need to understand how science works. Science works by criticism, and often statements made about climate change by one person or another are criticized, like somebody recently, Jim Hansen, the guy who informed the Congress in 1988 that the sea level was rising. Well, he says the sea level could rise as much as 10 feet by 2100. Well, he's gotten a lot of criticism for that, but that's okay. Don't throw out his opinion just because it's criticized. Remember, that's an opinion. That's one endpoint. Maybe it will. Probably it won't. But what I have found, besides learning facts about global climate change, it's also important to understand science and scientists and how we work.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you like this. This is a marvelous opportunity for me, and I hope that those of you, I hope that people living near the coast now will think about taking moves now, be planning now for movement, for moving your house. And if you're going down to near the coast, if you want to build, you want a house that's near the sea, you got to remember, if you can see the sea can see you, and act accordingly. And make your choices in the context of the science of global climate change that is going to impact in so many ways on all of us.
We have been talking with Duke University Professor Emeritus Oren Pilkey. From his vast record of publishing on The Way the Coastline Works, I'm working with his book, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Oren, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, for sure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A new study investigates the possible endgame example of extreme global warming hitting the ocean. Around 55 million years ago, during the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM, the ocean lost oxygen and it harbored dead zones. Large layers of the ocean became uninhabitable for multicellular organisms. That dying ocean condition started with a 5 degrees C warming, and that's just about what the IPCC predicts for the year 2100 at our current rate of greenhouse gas emissions. For me, warming in the global ocean is another sign we should break open the glass and pull the climate alarm. The study was published in the journal Science on August 24, 2018. We've reached the co-author, Dr. Ulrich Wortmann, Associate Chair of the University of Toronto Department of Earth Sciences. From Toronto, Canada, Ulrich, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
Getting to this paper, we know that around 55 million years ago, there was extreme global warming. A lot of species went extinct on land, including the last of the dinosaurs, another guest told me, and masses of small sea life on the ocean floor also died. Can you just tell us what happened then?
That's an excellent question, and there's no easy answer to it, because what actually really happened is still not very well known. What we do know is that the planet as such was warming, but in this process, something catastrophically happened, which accelerated that warming to almost modern levels. And some people think that the warming of the ocean released large amounts of previously frozen methane from the ocean floor. That is one hypothesis which is out there. But other people say, no, that's not possible. So it is not entirely clear what caused the warming, but it is an excellent example of what we call nonlinear effects, that we have some slow, continuous warming, and then some sort of trigger point is reached, and suddenly the whole climate system changes.
That's not really what I want to hear.
I'm sorry for that. Some people think it was like large amounts of volcanism related to the opening of the North Atlantic. So in one way or another, huge amounts of carbon dioxide were injected in the atmosphere. The PETM is interesting because it's about the same amount what it's projected, what we are going to put in the atmosphere by 2100.
Well, your new paper in Science talks about ocean deoxygenation, and that's also called ocean hypoxia. Can you tell us what that means?
Well, typically, we don't perceive it as such if we go diving, but the ocean water does have oxygen in it. Small amounts, not as much in the atmosphere, so we can't breathe it. Fish can breathe it through their gills. However, that oxygen, the only way to get it in the water is from the atmosphere, and then it is being used in the water through, for example, when organic matter is produced by photosynthesis producing oxygen, and then if organic matter dies, be it algae, fish, or whatever, they decompose, and that process consumes the same amount of oxygen which was previously released through photosynthesis again. So all this organic matter sinking down in the ocean consumes and sucks out the oxygen from the water. That means we have zones in the ocean where there are very low amounts of oxygen left in the water. This is called the oxygen minimum zone in the ocean.
We focus on the world that we know, you know, the land and the air, and how much it's warmed since pre-industrial times, and I'm told that's somewhere around 0.9 degrees C since 1860, if we don't count global dimming. but it is hard to find out how much the ocean has warmed. What is the situation with heating in the ocean?
Well, there's a recent study, actually it was just released 2 weeks ago or so, which was very cleverly designed, and they show that the ocean warming is much stronger than what we thought it was. The problem is we don't really have a good record what the ocean temperature is, right? We don't have, like, weather stations everywhere in the ocean, and those weather stations haven't been operated since 200 years. We have some remote sensing capabilities over the last 15 years, but that doesn't tell us much. So this study looked at how much gas has been released from the ocean into the atmosphere, and they can show that the ocean warmed much stronger and faster than anyone ever anticipated.
So the Wikipedia article, and of course all of us scientists use Wikipedia, but on ocean deoxygenation, it lists two ways the ocean warming causes loss of oxygen. Could you talk to us about that?
I'm not entirely sure what Wikipedia says, but there's basically two things. When the ocean gets warmer, its capacity to store gases, including oxygen, is reduced. Think of your Coca-Cola. If you leave it out in the sun and it gets warm, it gets really dull. Whereas when it's cold, it retains all the fizz. That's the same with the ocean. So if you heat the ocean up, it loses oxygen. That's one way to lose it. The other situation is that you need to recharge the oxygen in the ocean. That's done by circulation. So the ocean is constantly churning. But if that churning slows down, means you bring less oxygen back from the atmosphere back into the ocean. And what we do know for climate change is, first of all, there will be warming, so the capacity for oxygen is going down, and people think that the overturning rate, the churning of the ocean, will also slow. That means the supply of oxygen to the ocean is reduced.
James Lovelock talked about that as well, sort of the stratification of the ocean and how it just becomes too stable and living things require that mixing. Well, then, without any citation, Wiki says, quote, ocean model simulations predict a decline of up to 7% in global oxygen content over the next 100 years. Does that sound plausible to you, Ulrich?
Yeah, that sounds a reasonable number. I think what we have to consider, however, and that was the full focus of our paper, is that this decline may be actually much stronger. The 7% is just the decline in oxygen due to heat and maybe increased stratification. But what the PETM example shows is that there was a really sudden and very dramatic loss of oxygen during the PETM, which had nothing to do with stratification or temperature as such. Other processes kicked in, which led to the loss of oxygen.
Is this process of ocean deoxygenation a slow process? Or, well, you've just said it can happen quickly, and you did an earlier study about shifts in the ocean chemistry, let's say. But once it's begun, how long might it continue?
Well, you're asking a geologist, so time is pretty relative to us, right? 10 million years is nothing. So what is fast, what is slow? This is hard to answer.
Well, from a human perspective, I mean, is this going to end in 2100 like everything else in the IPCC, or is it going to go on for 1,000 years?
Well, the warming is going to go on for a long time. We know that from other model calculations, how long it's going to take for the CO2 to be sucked back out of the atmosphere and come to back to a stable value. I'd be hesitant to say, look, we're going to worry about that in 50 years from now. But I'd be very comfortable to say, yes, it's quite likely that effects like that will happen. But don't ask me when they will happen. Right? I would have to speculate. We don't have any data where we can say this. In the case of the PETM, it happened probably within 10,000 years. But what we do know is the way we change the climate at the moment is about 10 times faster. So maybe it happens in 1,000 years, maybe it happens in 200 years. That I don't know.
Well, 1,000 years sounds like nothing, but let's remember, if the Romans had done to the atmosphere what we've done to it, we'd be suffering with that now. So humans might want to think about 1,000 years. So look, we humans, we do understand oxygen. We breathe it. We want to hear all about it. But a big part of this story and your past work is about something else. It's about sulfur. And we do have an institutionalized aversion, I think, to learning about sulfur. It's the sign of the devil, and it's the rotten egg smell that we instinctively run away from. How does sulfur play into this story of ocean deoxygenation?
Now that you put it that way, okay. That's a pretty complicated question, I must say. So sulfur and carbon both exist either in its reduced form for carbon, that would be organic matter, or in an oxidized form, then we talk about limestone. And similarly, we have these changes for sulfur, where we go from pyrite, which is a mineral, to sulfate, which is in the ocean water. And carbon and sulfur together actually are the biggest consumers of oxygen in the atmosphere. So the balance between the two and how much organic matter you oxidize and how much limestone you reduce, that really controls the level of oxygen in the atmosphere. And the other component where these two go together, we use oxygen for breathing and energy. However, once oxygen is gone, other organisms, bacteria, are able to essentially breathe sulfate. Sulfate is the oxidized form of sulfur, and live off that. So this is where the story becomes interesting for us. So we trace sulfur, and suddenly what we find is that we see an incredibly large consumption of sulfate happening. And that can only be really explained by that all these animals which breathe oxygen are suddenly being replaced with life forms who breathe sulfur. And that's something what we see in the sulfur. And that's where we say, wow, so many of these, the only explanation is there must have been a real dearth of oxygen in the ocean so that there was enough room to do all this.
You may just have explained part of my next question, because you used sulfur isotope data in this study of the long ago PETM event, but I couldn't really understand how that told you what the oxygen level must have been. I mean, we don't have little bubbles in ice cores to measure what the oxygen level was. So can you tell us how you could understand what the oxygen level was so many millions of years ago?
Sulfur comes in different isotopes. And the interesting thing is when sulfur is being consumed by bacteria who use it for their metabolic functions, so let's say they breathe it, metaphorically speaking, they have a preference for the lighter sulfur isotope, sulfur 32. That means if we measure the sulfur isotopic ratio of seawater, we can get a pretty good idea how many bacteria and microbes are out there actually consuming sulfur. So that is something we can make a very good estimate of. And now what we see in the PETM is suddenly that the amount of sulfur-breathing life exploded drastically and consume much more sulfur than before. So the ocean starts losing sulfur 32 at a very rapid rate. And this is very difficult to explain unless you assume that suddenly we're replacing all these oxygen-breathing bacteria and processes with sulfate-breathing bacteria. So we can't really say anything directly about oxygen, but we can see something else is taking over the space of oxygen.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Ulrich G. Vortman from the University of Toronto. We are talking about potentially deadly changes to the ocean as global warming continues. So you co-authored an earlier paper in 2016 with K.W. Bauer about another oceanic anoxic event. What happened in that case?
Oh, that's like about 124 million years ago. In the Cretaceous, when the dinosaurs were all roaming happily. The current thinking is that we had a drastic increase in volcanic activity on Earth, and that would have released enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In that case, the carbon dioxide, when it mixes with rain, becomes an acid, which increases the dissolution of rocks. And in rocks, there are many little salts and minerals which are important for the life in the sea. So we did a big fertilization experiment, and suddenly we have algal blooms everywhere in the whole ocean. And all these algae, when they die, they consume oxygen in their decomposition process to the point that the ocean went completely oxygen-free. And we know that because the bottom of the ocean was covered in layers of organic material, so-called black shales. And we can only observe those black shales when the water in the ocean is actually oxygen-free. So that was a much more extreme version than the PETM. We know from the occurrence of these black shales that the oceans were oxygen-free. That, in turn, by the way, is what creates oil and hydrocarbon resources. So those events are actually, we're living off those events nowadays.
So that's interesting to know, but another of your earlier papers also seems relevant. It's titled Rapid Variability of Seawater Chemistry Over the Past 130 Million Years. We touched on this earlier. You found ocean chemistry remains pretty stable for long periods, but then can change relatively rapidly. That seems important to know now as our emissions heat up the ocean. True?
Now we need to really talk about timescales. So what we currently do with our climate change experiment we're having to do, we're changing the atmosphere on timescales of hundreds of years. In the PETM, the timescale was thousands of years, so much slower. And then if we go back into the Aptian, we start talking about millions of years. And if I talk about rapid changes to seawater chemistry, the ocean is something very big. So we're talking about 10 million years. So that's rapid. I think we shouldn't confuse these two things, right? The PETM was something which was incredibly rapid by geological standards, still a little slower than what we're doing today. But when we talk about the whole wholesale change of seawater chemistry, yeah, we're talking several million years. So that's beyond human time scale.
But do you think we could be seeing one of these destabilizing shifts in the ocean now? I mean, maybe humans are producing carbon dioxide so rapidly beyond geologic time, maybe we're just in the very early days of one of those shifts. What do you think?
Potentially, yes. I mean, as scientists, we are always concerned about what we call trigger points or nonlinear effects. So our current models all assume business as usual, then the ocean's going to heat like this, and we're going to lose a little bit of oxygen here and there. But what happens if something fundamentally in the system shifts and suddenly we may see that we lose oxygen at a much faster rate than we thought? And I think that's the point of our paper. We say, hey, guys, PETM, we had a similar amount of CO2 release. It was a little slower than today. But then very unexpectedly, we lost all the oxygen in the ocean. So that's something we need to be thinking about, that this could happen. I don't think it's far-fetched, but I'd be hesitant to tell you it's going to happen in the next 50 years.
Ulrich, you are also an advisor to the International Ocean Discovery Program, or IODP. Is that drilling for oil or drilling for science?
That is drilling for science. Okay. I mean, the oceans are two-thirds of our planet, and we know barely nothing about it. We know more about the moon than we do about the oceans.
Have you been on that Japanese scientific drilling ship? I think it's pronounced Chikyu. Or use data from it? Tell us about that.
No, I haven't, but a student of mine was lucky enough to sail for an expedition on this boat. It's the Japanese made a major effort to invest in a state-of-the-art drilling vessel, and they are obviously interested to learn more about the earthquake mechanisms in Japan. So this is a drilling vessel which is able to drill very deep into the earth. It enables us to retrieve data which we couldn't get to before. Fascinating and wonderful.
They drill really deep, don't they? I mean, almost down to the Earth's mantle in places, if you can find a shallow spot on the seabed, so to speak.
So to speak, yeah.
So one of the things that caught my eye while reading your paper was the increase in bacteria that process sulfides. Now, you probably have not heard of Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. He's been on Radio EcoShock. Let me tell you just for a minute. His 2007 book, Under a Green Sky, suggested that during a great ocean warming with oxygen depletion, sulfur-based life forms in the sea might have flourished so much that they released waves of deadly hydrogen sulfide into the atmosphere. And he thinks that may have helped a mass extinction on land at the time. Your paper describes mass death of fish and other organisms in the ocean as possible. Do you think a sulfur-based economy of living things in the sea could produce clouds of hydrogen sulfide reaching the atmosphere?
Yes, I think that's totally a possibility. You would need more extreme conditions than we encountered during the PETM. But if we look at our data, we can clearly say, okay, if this goes on longer and more intense, you can absolutely start see the degassing of hydrogen sulfide into the atmosphere. But again, we're talking about, that was the Permian mass extinction. We're talking about very extreme conditions. I don't think we're going to see any of that with our climate change experiment.
So how long does oxygen in the seawater have to go before sulfur-based bacteria start to take over, and are we anywhere near that yet?
Well, you can't really talk about the ocean as a whole because it really depends where in the ocean we are. So we already have zones where oxygen is really, really low, or if you go off the coast of Nigeria, there we actually have sulfur-breathing bacteria, and you get free hydrogen sulfide in the water. So it's all localized. These conditions we described, they do exist in the modern ocean in small spots. The point we're making is those spots actually became a global phenomenon.
This leads into another question that I had, which is when I look at maps of the dead zones that the newspapers report and that science puts out in maps, these oxygen-deprived areas are mostly clusters around the coast of industrialized or developing nations. So the U.S. East Coast and West Coast are littered with dead zones already, along with most of the coasts of Northern Europe, Japan, and China. Does your paper about this event long ago suggest the whole ocean experienced loss of oxygen or just certain parts of the world's ocean?
We have numbers which are on the order of 20 to 30% of the ocean volume, but that's big, right? The ocean is big, so that's a big number.
And your paper suggests low oxygen could, quote, jeopardize 10 to 50% of worldwide pelagic predator diversity with unknown consequences for global fish stocks. What sort of predators are we talking about here? Sharks? A predator fish like salmon? Or?
Well, shark, tuna, right, for example. Whales are not necessarily predators, which dive into those zones. The point we're trying to make is simply, we typically think about fish which live close to coast on the upper 200 meters, but there are a lot of fish which go much deeper into those zones where the oxygen may be replaced with sulfide. And what we know from other ecosystem studies is that predators play an incredibly important role in keeping an ecosystem in check and stable. So if we start losing tuna, if we start losing sharks, or their ecozones just shrink so much that the population starts to decline, then this may actually affect commercially important fish which live in shallow waters which are full of oxygen.
And a few billion people are at risk when they depend for protein on the fisheries that again depend on those predators. It's almost like the wolves are necessary to the herds that were wild in North America. So I'm wondering, how much will the total volume of low-oxygen water expand by 2100? Is that in your paper, and is it a meaningful number compared to the great deadening of the seas you studied in previous ages?
No, we don't have a number like that, what happens by 2100. Again, because the process we are concerned with was highly nonlinear and happened very suddenly. So this is like trying to make a forecast how the weather is going to be in 14 days from now, right? There's so much can go this way or that way. There are modeling studies out which are concerned with the loss of oxygen with traditional methods by heating, by stratification. And we do know that those changes should become measurable within the next 20 years.
Okay, well, let's go to one final quote from your paper's conclusion. It says, given the similarities between the PETM and the IPCC RCP 8.5 emission scenario, that's the business as usual one, and then I'll just paraphrase here, compression of where fish can live and threats to their ecosystem will be a possibility in the not too distant future. How is the PETM that happened around 55 million years ago, similar to the business-as-usual scenario published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? Where do those cross?
What is interesting is the amount of CO2 released is about equal in the business-as-usual scenario than to what happened in the PETM. So that gives us a pretty good idea what happens to the planet if we actually put all that CO2 in the atmosphere. So the PETM gives us certain guidelines what to expect down the road. And the other thing is what's important to understand, normally, if we talk about high CO2 and greenhouse climates, where there was no ice-free world, all these changes are super, super slow. They take millions of years. So for us, that CO2 changes very quickly. That happened really only once during the PETM. And what we see is pretty scary in the PETM. Not only because of hydrogen sulfide, we see a lot of other indications of massive changes to the climate. And so if this is any guide to what's ahead of us, then that's going to be interesting to say the least.
So how concerned are you personally about climate change? Should we worry?
Absolutely concerned. Climate change, this is what people rarely understand, is climate change is something scientists have picked up on for about the last 200 years they thought about it. The relationship between CO2 and temperature is well established for at least 80 years. And there's a lot we do not know, especially how fast things are going to happen. What we do see, however, is that models make errors. They do have errors, totally, and uncertainties. But those uncertainties on the low end are very well constrained. The uncertainties on the high end are very unconstrained. And my personal perception is that over the last couple of years, what we see is that all the models we had so far keep underestimating what's happening. So we're constantly correcting to a stronger response. More heat uptake in the ocean, more warming than we thought it would happen. Yeah, it's very disconcerting.
We have been talking with Dr. Ulrich G. Vortman from the University of Toronto Department of Earth Sciences. He is co-author of the paper Large-Scale Ocean Deoxygenation During the Paleocene Eocene Thermal Maximum, as published in Science, August 24, 2018. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Ulrich, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Oh yes, we live in exciting times. Politics became nail-biting reality TV. Information wars flow through our minds. We have everything to distract us from the judgment. I'm not talking about Robert Mueller or God. I'm talking about rising seas, annual firestorms, and millions of climate refugees. No belief is required to know climate change is here. Science has provided us with all the startling facts. Broadcast around the world by nonprofit radio and podcast, you have been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Join me in this fight for what's left of our climate at ecoshock.org. EcoShock.org. Thank you for listening and for continuing to care about our future.
Rough sea. Full moon. The tide is coming in.